Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.
Amiga, te tengo tremendo cuento. If you switch to AT&T, you can get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Galaxy S6 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone.
Why are you whispering so much? What are you talking about?
Great news. Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits.
What?
Oh, Norma, did you hear? $300 in credits when you switch to AT&T.
Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Galaxy S6 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Limited time offers. Requires port-in eligible service and trade-in. Get $100 bill credit applied within 90 days and $200 trade-in credit, which may be a promotion card. Fees, other charges, and restrictions apply. See store or att.com/summerbuyback for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Several miles from Hollywood. This is Vice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You come here. You come home. You come home fast. You come from the end of that. Je vous écoute.
Hello, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, we all have our favorite Olympic sport. Some people like the luge, some people are into the skating, but the one thing most of us have in common is that we regular people can't come anywhere close to the performance of the Olympic athletes. Sure, grandma can still strap on a pair of ice skates, but don't be asking her to do a triple Lutz. What grandma can do and what we all can do is train in thinking like thinking is a serious sport. But no, not by leaping to conclusions, that's what we do now, but by training our powers of observation and thought so we can avoid common human biases and rationality and find our way to the logical solutions to problems and even to the mysteries in our lives. My guest tonight, science writer and psychologist Dr. Maria Konnikova, draws on 21st century neuroscience and psychology to show us how we can employ Sherlock Holmes processes to improve our thinking and our lives. Stick with us tonight as we discuss her book, just out in paperback, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Hello, Maria.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for being here. So I want to start by asking you about the problem of the steps, which inspired you to write this book.
Absolutely. That was, in fact, the inspiration for the entire book. And it refers to a scene that happens between Holmes and Watson in A Scandal in Bohemia. And Watson and Holmes are sitting in their armchairs at 221B Baker Street chatting. And Holmes asks Dr. Watson, "Watson, how many steps lead up to 221B? And Watson has no idea. He doesn't know. And Holmes says, "Well, you know, that's the difference between us. You only see, I both see and observe." And I remember when I was a little girl, this really just was mind-boggling to me because I could sympathize completely with Watson. I mean, I had no idea how many steps led up to my house. I didn't know how many steps led up from the first floor to the second floor. I didn't know any of this. So it really hit home. So, you know, I promptly started counting steps everywhere I went. I think I ran outside right away to see how many steps there were so that I would do Holmes proud, which wasn't quite what he meant. So I think when I was little, I kind of missed the point, but still it was something that really just stuck with me. And what I didn't realize then was the point wasn't necessarily counting steps and trying to memorize the number of steps wherever you go. The point was this distinction that Holmes makes between simply seeing and both seeing and observing, or the way we just naturally go through life, which is just mindlessly letting the day go by, letting everything go by, and not really making an effort to interact. And seeing and observing, which is something much more active, something much more mindful. It's a way of really noticing details and making the conscious active choice to pay attention.
Yeah, and I love that distinction, seeing and observing. It actually reminds me to observe rather than just looking at things in my life since I read your book. And I guess probably you hear that from a number of people.
Oh, absolutely, and it's affected me as well. I mean, when I went into this, I assume most of us would like to think that we have a little bit of Sherlock Holmes in us, and I certainly went into the writing process that way saying, well, you know, I'm pretty observant, I'm pretty good. Then the more I dug into it, the more I realized, you know, I really don't observe all that often. It's really, really difficult to kind of be in that mindset and to really always make that choice to be present. And you just, once you start noticing it, you also start noticing how often you are in a sort of autopilot. You know, someone will say, hey, oh my God, did you just see that dog, you know, that walked right in front of you? Wasn't it cute? And I had no idea that there was even a dog there. So these things still happen to me, and I think that is, you know, it's a very important distinction, and keeping it in mind really helps you observe both the trivial things, like the dog in front of you, and really more important things, crucial details that can help you lead a better life.
And one thing we'll get into, that you get into in your book, Mastermind, is the nuances, because, of course, we can't just notice everything, and you talk about how to filter things. But I want to get back to what you were talking about. You talk about Holmes's method, that this is mindful interaction with the world. Mm-hmm. And you say that the idea of mindfulness is a new one, and you quote William James, who said about mindfulness, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again. He called it the very root of judgment, character, and will, and said an education that improves this would be an education par excellence.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a concept that psychologists have been grappling with for, you know, for centuries, literally. And it even predates psychology. Really, if you think about it, mindfulness goes back to Buddhism and has really much more spiritual beginning. But what William James meant and what cognitive psychologists since him have done, starting really in the 1970s with Ellen Langer's work, is to study, you know, let's strip this concept of its spiritual leanings, because not everyone is comfortable with that, and let's instead focus on what does this mean specifically for the brain. So what does it mean to be mindful? What is an education in mindfulness? And what it really means, if you're talking in from a cognitive psychology point of view, is nothing more and nothing less than attention. It's a conscious, active choice that we make minute by minute to pay attention, to be in the moment, to be present. And if you think about what your mind is normally like, I mean, normally your mind is just wandering all over the place. You're jumping from connection to connection. That's why you sometimes, you know, find yourself standing in front of an open fridge and you don't even remember that you were hungry or what in particular you wanted, right? You know, it happens to me all the time, because our brains have just kind of on autopilot jumped between different connections, and here we are in front of a fridge. And then we go back to wherever we were before because we can't for the life of us remember what we wanted. And then suddenly we're working and all of a sudden we remember again what it was. And so we say, aha, and you go back to the fridge, you know, an hour later for whatever you wanted the first time. And that's really our default state. That's the way that our brains normally work. And so this education in mindfulness that James referred to is a choice that you always have to make to note when your mind is wandering, to catch it in the act, and if it's important, to bring it back to the present moment. And that's even, you know, that's the typical instruction for if you're trying to teach someone mindfulness, that's exactly what you tell them to do. You say, you know, notice your distracting thoughts, acknowledge them and let them go, and then focus on what you were focusing on to begin with.
This is what I love about your book, Mastermind. You take everything into the practical area, because for a long time I'd hear that word mindfulness, and I mm-hmm. thought, you know, it's just like goddess yoga, crystals,
exactly.
You know, horrible stuff. But you're talking about mindfulness in a very well-founded way in terms of it's founded on research. And Langer's research shows us, as you say, that our brains are not built for multitasking, because we think we can do this, juggle all these things at one time. You say this precludes mindfulness altogether.
Absolutely. And multitasking itself, let me just back up a second and say that multitasking is a myth. That word doesn't exist in the way that we think it does, in the sense that it's physically impossible for our brain to pay attention to multiple things at once. So when you think you're multitasking, what you're actually doing is very rapidly switching your attention from stimulus to stimulus. So let's say, you know, you're talking on the phone and at the same time you're refreshing your email and you're, you know, looking at your Twitter feed. And I, not that I would ever do this. I'm always 100% present in my conversations. But for those people who might happen to do that, you think that you're very successfully monitoring everything. But how often do you realize that you missed the last thing that person said? Because all of a sudden a tweet caught your eye, an email caught your eye, and you switched your attention. And because you can't actually multitask, if you start to actively pay attention to your email, to your Twitter feed, to your Facebook, to whatever it is, then you stop paying attention to that original thing. And when we multitask frequently, when we do it habitually, we're really taxing our cognitive resources because it's very costly to keep switching your attention like that. So when I say mindfulness is difficult and cognitively costly, that's absolutely true, but so is multitasking, so is this rapid attention switching. In some ways, that's even more exhausting. That's why we become less productive when we work that way. And you know, the very pernicious thing about it is that we don't even realize it. We say, hey, I'm a great multitasker. I'm so good at this. I can get all this stuff done, not even realizing how much it's detracting from the quality and quantity of your work.
And you point out about our cognitive resources. It really is a problem when we divide them in that way. We do think that we are doing it well, but actually it is far more costly. And it brings to mind that line about the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that what we don't really realize is we don't give enough deference to the fact that our attention is finite. We somehow think that we can do it all, that, you know, we can stretch ourselves to a limitless point. We don't understand that. That's simply not true, that you have a very finite resource, and so you need to allocate it wisely. And every single choice you make, well, then there's a little bit less of that resource left. Now, of course, you can replenish it, and there are ways that we can replenish our attention, you know, either physical ways like eating, because we know that glucose is associated with cognitive function, or, you know, taking brain breaks, lots of things you can do. But while you're working, you know, you're taxing it and you're wearing it down, and the more costly choices you make, such as multitasking, the faster it happens. And as you say, you know, it's like the whole and the sum of the parts, except certain decisions deplete that whole exponentially, whereas others make that same resource last much longer.
I want to repeat what you said. I think this is so important, that our attention is finite. And we'll talk later. You have all these good ideas for how to control our allocation for it. One thing that I've learned, I'm a writer, and so I write really early in the morning, and by the afternoon, I realize my brain is just sort of pushing around words. But at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, I'm at my best cognitively. And if you realize that you have the best resources then, and you quoted a Roy Baumeister study, you referred to it. It was, I think, the one where the prisoners, the parole board, they would parole people at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the people who had the same offense at 4:30, they'd get stuck back in jail, you know, because they were just, their attention, they'd had it. And so if we realize that, we can know, don't make those decisions at four.
Right, that's exactly right. And if you're someone who's waiting for parole, make sure that you get the first slot. Don't go before lunch. That's the absolute worst, because everyone just wants to be on their lunch break and they're hungry. So yeah, these things really, really matter. And the interesting thing is, though, when you're aware of it in yourself, it doesn't quite go away. You know, these are things that are very, they're so powerful because they're, you know, you can be Roy Baumeister and still experience this effect, and even though you know exactly what's happening, you're still going to experience it to some extent. But you become much more aware and much better able to control these types of things. So I think that awareness is the first step always.
So you say that Sherlock Holmes' thinking was born of the scientific method. Can you explain that to us?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if we back up a moment to say that Sherlock Holmes was a fictional character, he's the creation of Arthur Conan Doyle, and Arthur Conan Doyle just so happened to be a doctor. So he had medical training, and he was always interested in the literature, not just in his field, which was ophthalmology, but in all of the different fields. So he loved Freud, for instance, and he went to all the conferences. This was something that was really exciting for him. And he had, while he was still at the University of Edinburgh for his medical training, he had a mentor, and that mentor's name was Dr. Joseph Bell. And Bell became the model for Sherlock Holmes. So Sherlock Holmes was born not only from a real person, but a person who was a scientist, who was a doctor, who used the scientific method as part of his day-to-day profession. And so when we look at Holmes's thinking, we can really see that precision and the fact that he approaches everything, even something that seems trivial, he doesn't take anything for granted. He approaches it like a science problem. You know, I would hope that if you were, you know, doing a lab experiment or you had received some new piece of scientific information, you wouldn't just take it on faith. You'd actually test it. You'd go to the lab, you'd set it up, you set up your experiment. You know, if you remember your high school science, it went something like that. But when it comes to thinking and ideas, we're not nearly so precise. We think that just because we hear it, it's true, or just because we've thought it, it must be true. So that scientific method, when you apply it to thought, what it really means fundamentally is this innate skepticism, always asking the questions, always testing, never taking anything at face value. So that's all to say that Holmes came from a place of science, and what we see in this fictional character is that type of science taken to an extreme. This is how we would do it in an ideal world.
Yeah, and you note also that Holmes' thinking is an essential part of Holmes' thinking is this natural skepticism and inquisitiveness toward the world, that he doesn't take anything at face value. We'll get back to that. I have to do a little commercial. We have a new sponsor. I'm very excited about this. Our show sponsor is Audible.com. They're the leading provider of audiobooks, which I love to listen to in the car. Makes me not want to kill other drivers quite so much because I live in LA and that's what you want to do when you're on the road here. So you can get a free audiobook download and support this show at the same time at no cost to you by signing up for a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/AmyA. And that's in our little show write-up if you forget that. audibletrial.com/AmyA. It's $14.95 a month after 30 days, but you can cancel before then and have it cost you nothing. And so, again, to give me credit for this, type in audibletrial.com/AmyA. And, again, it's in the online blurb for this show. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in science. My guest tonight is science writer and psychologist Dr. Maria Konnikova, and her book is Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. So you talk about thinking fast and slow. We've talked about this a few times on the show. It's Kahneman's work on this. And our fast system is our intuitive system, and the slower system is our rational system. I love this. You call the fast system the Watson system, who you bash a little bit in the book, and rightfully so. And you call the slow system the Holmes system. So explain to us Watson versus Holmes thinking.
Well, it really all goes back to that initial scene, those steps that we started the interview with. I think that the core difference is the Watson system is that seeing, mindless, quick to action, intuitive, hot, however you want to call it, reflexive system. So you just kind of spur of the moment, go, 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 you just act. And you just kind of drift along. That type of system wouldn't take the time to notice how many steps lead up to 221B. It just sees. And System Holmes is, as you say, the slow system. It's also the reflective system. It's the cool system. It's the system that always takes a step back, takes everything in, and only then comes to a decision. And that decision can involve a decision to say, I don't care how many steps there are, but you've made that choice conscious. So you say, you either notice and say, okay, I know exactly how many steps lead up to 221B, or you say, this is not a piece of information I care to retain, but I am the one making the choice, and it's not being made for me because I've just kind of mindlessly drifted through the environment. And I do want to rehabilitate Watson a little bit, and I do say this in the book. You know, Watson is really essential, and System Watson is essential. And Watson is really smart. I mean, he's a doctor. He's not a bumbling fool. He's a smart person who really adds a lot to Holmes's thought process and to Holmes's development as a detective and as a human being. But there is this distinction in the way that Watson approaches the world and the way that Holmes approaches the world. But the key point is that we need both of them. I think you alluded to this earlier. You know, you have to always kind of be selective. Sometimes it's perfectly fine to just be in System Watson, kind of on autopilot, and that way you're rebooting, you're saving your cognitive resources for the times where it really matters to be in your System Holmes mode.
Yeah, and I think you've made a great point about Watson, rehabilitating him a little bit, that Holmes used him as a sounding board. And you point out a number of times in your book, Mastermind, that, you know, that Holmes would educate Watson on things. Watson would do his fast thinking, and Holmes would then use him to sort of think out and talk out the slower system. And I think that that's a good thing, that for those of us who want to think like Holmes, if you can get somebody, either you pay them. I have a guy that I pay to give me counterpoints. He edits my stuff and fights with me. That's his job, and to tell me I'm dumb and this isn't good enough. And you can do that, or you can do that with a friend and exchange work or exchange thinking. You can just do it over coffee in the morning, test your thoughts with somebody, and that's very valuable.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the key strategies that enables Holmes to improve, is talking through with Watson, because things that made perfect sense in your head don't always make sense when you say them out loud. Saying it out loud, actually talking through it, enables you to see logical leaps that you had made that you didn't realize were there. It enables you to see incorrect steps that your logic took, and enables you to see gaps. And even if you don't have someone available, you can always do this with yourself. You know, one of the pieces of advice I've often received as a writer is read everything out loud. And I used to think that that was completely bogus, but it's not. It really helps you see things that your eye missed, because you're almost, instead of just relying on your inner eye and your kind of inner voice, you are now plugging in your ears, and you're plugging in a different sense. And so you have to not only say it, but hear it. And all of a sudden you hear things that don't make as much sense as they had when you were just quickly going through that with your vision. So I think that, you know, while it would be absolutely wonderful to have a Watson, that's ideal, even if you don't have anyone, you can still be your own Watson in a sense. You might not be quite as good, but it's still better than nothing.
You also write about the value of writing things down. One of the bits of advice you have at the end of the book is keep a diary. And this is just my experience writing science. I will think, you know, I know certain principles of science. I know them pretty well. But then if I have to describe them to you, suddenly I'm a little bit lost. And having to write stuff down helps you articulate things in your head in a way that really makes sense, ingrains things that maybe you had a 70% grasp on, so you have a much greater grasp. And you say that vis-a-vis this sort of Holmesian thinking, to keep a diary, that you say that it helps you understand things that you think you know cold, and sort of do that checking about what they're really saying and whether they're making sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Because writing is much more objective than your own mind and your own memory. I mean, we really have to learn that we can't trust ourselves. Not only is our memory terrible, I mean, memory is a horrible liar, but we also know it's absolutely true. So we think that if we remember it accurately, then we remember it accurately, and that's just simply not the case. But we also kind of, things slip, things change. We might have noticed something, but then we forget it because we start almost tricking ourselves. Our reasoning becomes motivated reasoning, which means that now you're not just being logical, you're trying to make your reasoning fit a certain point that at some point you decided was correct. So one of the things that writing things down enables you to do is to try to remain a little bit more objective, because it's kind of a check on these things that your mind naturally wants to do.
I love the sections in your book, Mastermind, about memory. You talk about the Scooter Libby effect, and this is psychologist Karim Kassam's name for how at his 2007 trial, former presidential aide Scooter Libby claimed no memory of having mentioned the identity of certain CIA employees to any reporters or government officials, and the jurors didn't buy it. They thought, how could he not remember something so important? And you write, simple, it wasn't nearly as important at the time as it was in retrospect, and where motivation matters most is at the moment we are storing memories in our attics to begin with, and that's your name for the brain, which I love, and not afterward. So
absolutely.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, so that's a concept known as motivation to remember. If we're motivated to remember something, we're much more likely to remember it. So when you make a new memory, when you encode it, when you put it into your brain attic, a lot of very complicated processes are happening, and your memory is not the same for every single event. Some events are more vivid than others. That's just the way that it works. And certain things, such as, you know, emotional content, really make a memory pop. But one other thing is, how important is it to you? Your mind is very adept at trying to remember things that it deems important. So you know ahead of time that this is something that you want to remember, whether it's because, you know, it's personally relevant to you, or because it's an interest that you've developed, or it's a hobby, whatever the case may be. And if that doesn't happen, though, you are going to forget it, because, once again, your mind is smart, and it makes very smart choices. And it doesn't have all the space in the world to make all the memories in the world, so certain things are not going to get stored nearly as well. And if that initial encoding, if that initial impression wasn't strong enough, well, you're not going to be able to access it later on. You can't, in retrospect, go back and say, hey, that was important. What was it again? If it's gone, it's gone. So really, that moment, that first moment is the moment where we can exercise the most control over what will be in our memory, what we will be able to recall later on.
Well, how can we motivate ourselves to remember in that moment?
Well, I think the first step, as I think is the case with most of this, is awareness. So if you know that your brain actually works this way, then you can make a conscious effort to say, hey, brain, I want to remember this. This is really important. So you almost like put a little flag or a post-it note on it to help it, you know, to help your brain say, hey, this is important. And then, you know, you can play little tricks. So we know, for instance, that memory is strongest when it has multiple points of input. So basically, if you think about it as a file, the more different labels and cross-labels you have on that file, the easier it will be for you to retrieve it later on, because you'll be able to remember any of those labels and not just one key label. And so if you know that, then you can label memories almost. You can connect it to things you already know. You can use different senses so that you have, you know, a visual point of remembering it. You can note the smells, and then you have suddenly, you know, fragrance that can bring it back, and that's very powerful. You can note sounds. You can note touch. So there are all of these different ways that you can add one more sticky to that memory, and that way when any of those stickies come up, you'll be able to retrieve the memory. Whereas if you only have one, well, it's better than if you had none, which is if you didn't have that motivation, but it's obviously worse than if you had 10.
Now, you talk about very interestingly in your book, Mastermind, how Sherlock Holmes would leave some things out of his brain attic. And I have a problem with, I've so much that I want to remember. And so one of the choices I've made, I hope none of my friends are listening, and I do know most of your names, I'm sure, but when people tell me their names, I ignore them. I just, it's too much to remember. I don't want to put in that energy. But there's a new hostess at my favorite bar restaurant, and I thought, oh, it'd be nice, you know, if I come in and I don't say, hi, you know, blank. And her name's Natalia. And so what I did was I thought of, it's a sort of Russian name, and I thought of Boris and Natasha, but it's Natasha and there's an L. And I was able, she looks like Natasha in the little cartoon, I was able to remember her name. So tell me if that's good or if I could have done better.
No, that's definitely good. I think that you caught on to something very important, which is the more personally relevant you can make it, so the more you can relate it to your own body of knowledge, the better chance you have of remembering it. So for you, you know, she even looks like Natasha and you're familiar with the cartoon, so that's a good strategy. For me, you know, I might have remembered War and Peace, for instance, because that's a book that, you know, made quite an impression on me when I was younger. And so, you know, it's really trying to find the thing that is going to trigger it for you personally, because memory is a very personal thing. And it's great what you did. You know, it wasn't just the name. You tied it to her face. You tied it to, you know, different visual inputs, which makes you much more likely to remember it. And by the way, you're not the only one. It's really hard to remember people's names. There are lots of strategies for doing so, but most of us have that exact same problem. If you think it's a problem, some people don't really care.
Some people don't, and I just try to do it gracefully, let people introduce each other to themselves and themselves to each other. Now, you talk about in motivation how important both mindfulness and motivation are, and I love this term you quote by Ellen Winner about the rage to master, which describes intrinsic motivation to conquer a specific domain. And talk about how that plays into what you're talking about with Holmesian thinking.
Well, I think one of the amazing things about Sherlock Holmes is just how curious he is. So he is someone who really, you know, his brain is always hungry. He has a curiosity for all sorts of topics. So this is this, you know, urge, this rage to mastery, where he really, you know, he wants to excel. He always wants to go deeper. He always asks why. And that's a very active kind of present way of being, because you can imagine the opposite is the case, where nothing really interests him, and so any new piece of information, he says, oh, that's interesting. But he's not actually going to then go on and pursue it. And so he's never going to become as expert at a topic as someone who has that drive for mastery. So you can think about it as, you know, two different students in a history class, for instance. And one of the students is very diligent and takes lots of notes, and everything the professor says he writes down, and, you know, he'll do fine, he'll do well in the class. Now the other student is really kind of, this stuff really fascinates him, so he goes out and he does extra research, and he starts, you know, someone mentions Cromwell, so he gets a book on Cromwell, and lo and behold, all of a sudden he's reading about all of these different things. Well, he's going to be, at the end, the better student, who's able to make more connections, who's able to be more persuasive, because he had this interest to really go deeper, and his mind is much more active. And 20 years down the line, he's going to remember that class much, much better than the student who just diligently wrote down what he was told and then, you know, spewed it back onto the test.
Well, I want to talk about the problem of inertia, which you say is a default position for us. But first, this is Amy Alcorn's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Maria Konnikova, and her book is Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. So you say basically the path of least resistance is so tempting to us to just be, you know, fall back, not do anything. How can we combat that?
Well, it's true. I mean, we are naturally, for the most part, quite lazy. And I think that we can combat that by trying to kind of recapture almost our inner child. You know, if you think about it, most children aren't lazy. Most children are really curious. They always ask you why this, and you answer, and then they have a different why. And, you know, soon you're really sick of all of the whys, and you want to just say, just because, you know, I don't know, stop asking me why. But we do have, when we're little, this kind of drive to really be curious, and then we lose it. We become much more complacent. We do, you know, the bare minimum, and that's perfectly fine to function. But if you look at the people who really excel, they're the people who do go deeper. And so, you know, you ask, how can we cultivate that? And that's a difficult question to answer, in the sense that I think we have to decide for ourselves that We want to be interesting people, and I think we'd all like that in the abstract. We just need to realize that nothing comes from nothing, and that if we don't expend the energy, there's nothing intrinsically great about you, ever. There's nothing intrinsically great about any of us. We are not unique. We're not above average. You know, you have to kind of accept that as a starting point, and so you say, well, I have to work if I'm going to be above that. And that means I have to be involved. I have to be invested. I have to kind of rekindle my curiosity about the world, about different topics. And that doesn't mean you have to be curious about everything and disengage with everything. Pick, think what kinds of things that you want to be good at. What do you want to talk about in conversations? What do you want to be distinctive about you? And then you can, you know, you can kind of try to form yourself into the type of person you'd like to be.
And I see the upside of we're all average, and you bring this out many times in your book, Mastermind, that the converse is that you can develop yourself, that you don't have to be a genius, that you can develop these this form of thinking, the Holmesian thinking, and one way is to do the thing that he so often does in these books, which is to experiment in figuring out who people are, what they do, to practice that. And you say practice is a very, very important part of this.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And I think that's something that we don't necessarily realize is by the time we meet Sherlock Holmes in the first Conan Doyle story, he's already Sherlock Holmes. You know, we don't meet him as a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 20-year-old, even a 30-year-old. We meet him as a fully formed adult who already has his profession and who has years upon years upon years of practice at this mode of thinking. And so we look at him and we say, oh, well, this is impossible. And yet, it's, you know, he didn't start out being Sherlock Holmes. He put in countless hours of practice. And that realization that really nothing comes from nothing, as I already said, that you really need to start and apply yourself, that you're not suddenly going to become like Holmes, that it's going to take a lot of work, I think that's a really important realization. I mean, Watson gets better throughout the stories, but it's hard for him. He has a lot of bad habits that he needs to break. So Watson is, in that sense, an interesting counterpoint because he's someone who's very professionally successful on the one hand, but on the other hand, hasn't learned to cultivate that type of thinking more broadly. I'm sure he's actually quite mindful and quite Holmesian in his thought when he's, you know, seeing a patient, when he's doing something that is his profession and something he's been trained in because he has a lot of practice at that. But he's never really gone beyond that. He's never made a point of really developing that sort of approach to the world. You know, he says himself that his main interests are going to his club, drinking, socializing, womanizing. So he's never really gone in for that type of Holmesian approach more broadly.
And with practice, you talk about how experts, you can become an expert, that experts through practice are able to detect patterns that aren't obvious to the untrained eye. We talked about this on my show with Paul Tuff, about people who are chess masters. They see details as part of the whole, and they're used to seeing these patterns happen, so they're able to pick them out in a way people who aren't practiced aren't able to do.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That goes back sort of to what I was saying earlier about the accuracy of your memory. What you see, so if you and I were looking at the exact same scene from the exact same vantage point, we wouldn't be seeing the same thing because you bring your memories, you bring your experience, you bring your expertise, what you're, you know, what you've developed with you. So for instance, if I'm in my kitchen and, or not even my kitchen, if I go into your kitchen and I'm someone who's a professional chef, I'm going to remember a lot of details. I'll be like, oh, I know that type of oven. That's a great oven. And, oh, I see that you have this and that and that. And, oh, look at those knives. You know, I'm instantly evaluating everything with an expert eye. If I'm someone who just always orders delivery and don't really cook at all, you know, I see it in a very different light. I might not even notice that you had knives out there. I just simply don't remember it because I don't have that depth of seeing. So it doesn't even have to be something like a chess match. It can be something as simple as going into the kitchen.
And you mentioned before how important it is to recognize how unreliable memory is. You write about Elizabeth Loftus' studies on eyewitness testimony and how we can be primed to remember things in a certain way. She had used different language and asking people mm-hmm. to describe footage of a car accident. This is called the misinformation effect, and it affected what they remember. And I think we don't realize how bad our memory is, how unreliable it is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And by this point, Loftus has been doing this for decades, and each study is scarier and more persuasive than the last. I mean, she has found that the tiniest things affect your memory for really, really important events, and that you can misremember. You can remember something that never happened. You can fail to remember something that did happen. I mean, these distortions are huge. And yet, eyewitness testimony is still used, and people will still place more weight on eyewitness testimony than on any other piece of evidence in a courtroom, because that is the strength of our faith in the fact, well, you know, he saw him. That's the end of the story. We really believe that our memories are just, you know, snapshots, accurate depictions of what happened, when really it's just something that's constantly changing. And the funny thing is, the more often we retrieve the same memory, so if there's a story that you tell over and over, the less you can rely on it, because every single time you retrieve it, then when it goes back to its resting space, wherever it was in your brain attic, it changes slightly. So what you may remember 20 years later is the version you've been telling and not the version that actually happened. And the telling will change a little and certain details will shift, and all of a sudden you'll remember that as the truth and not the actual event. So it's really scary.
Yeah, what you're saying is so important about witnesses. Christopher Chabri talked about this on my show. And actually, Carol Tavris, who's sort of a queen in the psychology area in terms of how I think of her, I'm a big fan of her work. She talked about how she just made something up in her head. She thought it was true, and someone pointed out to her that it couldn't possibly be true. Now, she's not a liar. This is this effect, and she's a psychologist who studies this. And I used to think, I didn't make this up, I wasn't going to steal a joke, that line, that looks like a penis, only smaller, that people say when someone exposes themselves to them, that happened to me in New York a few times. That just happens if you live there a few times. And I swore in my head that I made that up. You know, and it's just something that happens to us in our minds. And if we realize that, it's so important what you're talking about, to realize how inaccurate we are, and especially because Loftus's, some of her studies have been on these recovered memory cases where people just implanted, quote-unquote, memories into children's minds, and people went to jail for a very long time for this when they didn't do anything. They weren't members of a satanic cult, molesting children.
Yeah, no,
it's
really terrible, and it's really scary, and it has lasting consequences. And yet, you know, I don't know what Loftus has to do to beat this into people's heads, because nothing has changed. I mean, our legal system is exactly the same as it was before we knew any of this, and jurors still have no idea that this is the case. And we say, oh, this poor child, you know, it's so difficult to talk about, you know, child abuse and sexual abuse, it must be true. Well, no, it's incredibly easy, I mean, especially with a child, because children's memories are even more malleable. It's really easy for them to misremember things and to also take other people's memories as their own. So they might have heard a story and then they just take it on for themselves. And that happens to adults as well, but children's memories are especially prone to this. So it's really disturbing that as a society, we have not really integrated any of this science into our way of thinking or our way of judging guilt and innocence.
It's absolutely terrible, and I wish that attorneys who are presenting cases in court would bring some of this up, because there are many innocent people who have been convicted based on this. We see the backstory on it, that people, the DNA evidence comes out in some old case, and the eyewitness, oh, actually they didn't see them, but they mm-hmm. saw their picture or something. And you talk about another bias is the availability heuristic, which mm-hmm. is that what's most available in our minds tends to come to the top. So maybe if the cop showed you, it's called a six-pack of photos of possible criminals, maybe two of them are cops and one's a derelict and one is a person who's suspected, and then you see a lineup and that person is in there, well, you've seen them, so it's called primed to think that maybe you remember them from the crime scene.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and that's something that that particular aspect of it, I feel like I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I feel like they've started trying to implement certain things in what photographs they show people and how they show them. But so I think that there's a little bit of change in that, but it's still very, very far from where we need to be. Because as you say, you know, priming, availability, recency, all of these things play an incredibly important role in what we think we know and what we think we remember. And the kicker is that we really, really, really are convinced that we're right. And if someone were to argue and try to tell us otherwise, we're going to contradict them, because the more, you know, once you say it, the more convinced you become in it, and then you don't want to let go of it. It becomes increasingly difficult to tell you, hey, this never actually happened. I'm going to fight you. I'm going to say, no, it did happen.
Yeah, and I think a way, as you said, and as you do say in your book, to fight this is to be very aware of our biases. And I should tell people who I'm talking with. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with writer and psychologist Dr. Maria Konnikova, and her book is Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. And now you say that Holmes's trick, one of the ways that he avoids getting caught up in these biases, is to treat every thought, experience, and perception the way he would a pink elephant.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely right. So the concept comes from this idea that in order to process any piece of information, no matter how absurd it may be, like a pink elephant, you have to initially assume it's true. So in order to say, no, pink elephants don't exist, that's just silly, I have to, for a second, when you say pink elephant, take it and say, oh, a pink elephant. So I believe it before I disbelieve it. I have to hold it in my head and then compare it against what I know as reality. And that sort of thinking goes to everything. So every single thing we're told, every single thing we see, every single thing we hear, our initial default position is belief. And you have to switch from belief to disbelief. So that's kind of the active thing that you have to do. So what happens if you're otherwise occupied? What happens if you're cognitively busy, if your brain is focused on other problems? You are much less likely to make that switch because you just don't have the mental resources. And so it gets filed away erroneously in your mind as true. You might even misremember that I was telling you that actually, yes, there used to be pink elephants. You're saying, oh, I remember on the radio somewhere hearing about pink elephants. I guess it must be an extinct type of elephant, or maybe they're talking about, you know, some different hue of skin. So if you don't actually take the time to disbelieve, it's going to get incorrectly placed in your head as something that's true. And that's something that we also need to be very aware of. So when I say Holmes treats every thought like a pink elephant, you know, a pink elephant is a very egregious example. It's very difficult for you to say, oh, pink elephants exist. And Holmes takes that approach to everything, even things that seem innocuous. So no matter what I say, no matter what statement I make, no matter what he sees or hears, he's going to say, okay, is this actually true, or do I need to switch it to that false position? It's a question we don't often ask ourselves. We often just assume, if we don't have any cause to think otherwise, that, oh, that must be true.
Well, one thing that you talk about in your book, Mastermind, that helps us consider things in an open-minded way is to be both engaged, actively involved, not multitasking, and then also to disengage. And you talk about how Holmes would smoke a pipe or a few pipes, and how other people swim, or Nietzsche would walk, or that meditation is another helpful thing, that you need to stand back a little bit from the problem sometimes to be able to get proper distance from it.
That's absolutely right. One of the things that we make the mistake of doing, and I think that it's something that modern society really reinforces, is this constant mentality of motion. So you have to keep moving. You have to constantly be in this go, go, go state. If you're not always moving, always doing something, then you're being unproductive. So every time that someone takes a step back, I think that we as a society kind of see it as wasting time. Hey, why did you take a lunch break? You could have been working for that hour. Why did you take a walk? You could have been using those 20 minutes to, you know, catch up on this PowerPoint presentation. What we don't realize is that it's not wasting time. It's making yourself both more productive and more correct. We need to learn that habit of, instead of being constantly moving and thinking that the only way forward is to really just run mentally, you know, this figurative running of the brain, but that we really should slow down and that we're going to make better decisions, we're going to do things better if we stop valuing speed quite as much as we do and start realizing that these breaks are often much more important.
Yeah, I really think that businesses so undervalue napping and that they should have little closets for that. When I started reading all the science on cognitive energy, I started napping, and I trained all my friends never to call me. We communicate by email. The phone rings. It's either a telemarketer or my boyfriend, who I send little nappy texts to so he won't wake me up. But it's really important, because I say that about how I'm just sort of a dimwit in the afternoon, but I can reboot a little bit if I take a 20-minute nap. And you talk about the different ways to do this. It's so important to do that. Take a walk. Put the laundry in the dryer if you work at home. Mm-hmm. Do something to get away. Maybe that's multitasking, but I find it sort of mindless. So so that works.
That absolutely works.
The loop, yeah. It's just very important.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think that most of us do feel that it's wasting time. You know, saying, well, I'm doing the laundry when I should be working, you know, on this article. Well, that's not... Absolutely. Well, of course, you might be wasting time, but if you're doing it strategically, you know, then you're not. You're letting your brain kind of mull things over. And sometimes I'm so impressed with the fact that when I come back to my desk to write, the article kind of writes itself almost, because my brain has been working through a lot of these ideas, and something that seemed, you know, prohibitive, that I would never get it done, all of a sudden I'm words are coming out. Soon I have 100, 200, you know, and it slowly builds up. So I think we need to reframe it, not as time wasting, not as procrastination, but as brain space, as reclaiming quiet, reclaiming that part of your mind that enables you to think efficiently the other time, recharging.
I love that, brain space. These are necessary breaks. And for someone, I don't know if anyone works on a timer, from having heard me talk about it on the show, but you do, when you're a writer, find all these things to do that are really important, like you'd have to dust your moldings and things when it's time to write. So I put a timer on, and I have to write for an hour, even if I think I'm convinced I'm the most unclever, terrible writer in history. You just do that, and then you get into what you talk about, flow. But by the same token, I also have now, so I won't take an hour off, I set my timer for 20 minutes and do something else. I do the dishes. Mm-hmm. I exercise a little. I do something that's not just sitting staring at the computer having my blood come out of my forehead.
I think that's incredibly important, that that's something that we'd all do well to remember. I love the fact that you use... a timer. That's a really effective tool. The way that I use it kind of surreptitiously is to make myself really focus, is I actually use a software on my computer called Freedom, which is a timer of sorts, because I tell it for how long between a minute and 8 hours I want it to shut off my internet. And exactly. So what happens while Freedom is working is I say, you know, 2 hours. So for 2 hours, I can't go online no matter what I do. My computer just will not do it. It's wonderful software. I highly recommend it. But that also ensures that you're writing for that period of time. So I think that it's a really good approach, and something that, you know, while everyone, to each his own, I think that's something that can translate from person to person pretty well.
Yeah, you have to figure that out. And I need the internet when I'm writing. I need to look things up. So I end
I used to think I did too. Now I just put placeholders for the things that I need to look up, and then I'll look them all up later. Because normally what happened is I'd be like, oh, I need to know this scientific thing. So then I go online, and lo and behold, an hour has passed because looking that up has led to other things. So for me, I now put little placeholder notes saying, you know, I need to check this. I need to make sure this is accurate. I'm going to say, you know, 10, but maybe it's 12 and maybe it's 7. But I'm not going to take the time to check right now.
See, it is an each to his or her own thing, but I find that either way, I mean, your way sounds wise too, and it's just whether people need to do that or not. They have some form of timer, because we realize, I mean, I'm just like this big child, and I just want to play and go on Twitter and all this other stuff, but I just, you know, you talk about too in Mastermind about habit, that you instill habits, and so my habit has been, don't you go on the internet. Don't you check your email, bad girl. I talk to myself like a small bad dog. And because of that, that I instilled this habit that I just don't do it and I behave well, then I, you know, it's just sort of what I do. And so it, either way, you know, whether you start with your timer or mine, my kind of timer, it's just good to have this timer where you're controlling, this is my workspace. And then also have the converse where you have, this is my time off. So my brain can do that thing in the background where it chews on the problems while you're smoking a pipe. Well, I don't smoke a pipe, and I imagine you don't either. Or taking a walk or playing with your dog or whatever it is, that time off thing that you're doing.
That's absolutely right. And I actually put that time off on my calendar. So I use Google Calendar to, you know, schedule my day, and I have breaks scheduled in there so that, you know, I have a very strict structure to the day, because I work from home, you know, I'm my own boss, and I have to, you know, I have to make sure that I'm optimally productive. So it's an, you know, I take it maybe to an extreme, but scheduling those breaks, you know, makes it. And sometimes, you know, I'll go over by half an hour because I'm really on a roll. But at least mentally I know that I need to take it. And scheduling that nothing time I think is great.
Well, that's great advice. And now we've talked about a number of our cognitive biases, and you talk about more of them in your book. And I'm talking with Dr. Maria Konnikova. Her book is How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Sorry, it's called Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. I'm staring at the cover. Sorry about it, upside down. But you say we can't stop our minds performing basic judgments or control every piece of information that we retain, but you say that Holmes knows the biases of his mind attic, like the back of his hand or the strings of his violin, and that, for example, he knows that if he focuses on a pleasant feeling, he'll drop his guard. If he lets a physical feature get to him because we think better of attractive people, he will run the risk of losing objectivity. So I think it's very good advice here that we need to really know the ways we are irrational.
I think that's exactly right. I think that one of the things that we can take away from Holmes, really take away from him, is just this awareness. Because I think a lot of people misconstrue Holmes as someone who doesn't feel emotion, as someone who is immune to all of these things, when that's simply not true. He feels it, but then he makes an active choice to discount it right away. So it's not, for instance, that he doesn't notice that Mary Morstrom, who becomes Watson's wife, is incredibly attractive. He just, unlike Watson, who all of a sudden, because she's attractive, thinks that she's sweet and nice and all of virtuous, angelic, all these wonderful things, and she hasn't even said a single word, Holmes says, okay, she's attractive, got it, that's it. I am not going to let that color anything. And knowing that he does experience those feelings, and then he just makes a choice to put them on hold, to put them aside, because he realizes that they are going to influence how he thinks, I think that's really important, because I think it makes it a lot more attainable. You can think of it as, well, I don't have to be cold, I don't have to be robotic, I don't have to be, you know, this automaton. I just have to be someone who's aware that my feelings and all of these different things that I see and experience are going to affect my judgment in very specific ways. And if I know those ways, well, then I can build kind of a discount factor into how I perceive it. And so I can try to factor that into the conclusions that I draw and the impressions that I have.
I think this is very important advice. Recognize your biases and then put them aside, put them on a shelf, which leads me to this question that you bring up. how do we train ourselves to tell the crucial from the incidental?
That's the million-dollar question. That's something that I think everyone has to decide for themselves. It's really a much broader question about life. It's a question about what type of person do you want to be 10 years from now? Meaning, what are the things that are important to you? What types of memories do you want to have? What kinds of experiences do you want to affect your thinking? Because we need to realize that our brain attic travels with us wherever we go. And so it always colors our world, colors what we see, colors the way that people see us. And so for us, what becomes important may not be the same things that are important for Holmes. For him, it's a very specific calculus because he's a detective, so he needs to, you know, remember all these different things about people, about scenery. But he might not notice the weather unless it's important for a crime, and he might not notice a lot of things that aren't really pertinent to what he's doing at the moment. And for you, you know, you might not want to be a detective, but you need to actually just stop and ask yourself, well, what's important to me? What are the things that I really want to get out of life professionally, personally, at all of these different levels? And once you answer that, that tells you what the crucial is. That is going to help you in every single situation determine what you need to be focusing on and what isn't important.
That is wonderful advice, to see this through our own values, because then it's really, we're personalizing it, and it really has to be personalized. Mm-hmm. Now, we are almost out of time, but it's been such a wonderful show, and I have to say, your book really helped me. I became a person who doesn't just look, but who observes, and not like I was some totally lazy thinker beforehand, but just being made to realize all these things you bring out about, here's our bias, here's how we see, here's something we're prone to. Really, really important stuff. So leave us with some final words of wisdom on how to think like Sherlock Holmes.
Well, I think I'll leave you with something that I end the book with, which is that if you take only one thing from it, it's that the most powerful mind is the quiet mind. It's this knowledge that the world is never going to slow down. The world isn't going to change. What we need to learn is how to take control of our own minds, because nothing is going to change around us. So the only thing that we have control of is how do we think. And we need to learn how to quiet our thinking, how to really focus, how to really reclaim our full mental capacity by cultivating this kind of inner mindfulness that will then help us deal with a world that won't ever slow down for us, no matter what we do.
Thank you. That is just such wonderful advice. Thank you, Maria, so much for being on. This is Advice Goddess Radio. Amy Alcon. I've been talking with Dr. Maria Konnikova, and her book is Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Thank you again. That was a wonderful, wonderful hour.
Thank you, Amy.
Changing a song can change your whole day, but change has never...